Well, good morning. Looks like we did turn out with a pretty good crowd, didn't we? You guys must have thought you might miss something today. You thought you better be here, right? I don't blame you. It would be nice if that would happen. It's always been speculated by many that the coming of Christ would return on this day, the Feast of Trumpets. It'd be great if we did hear that sound, wouldn't it? The shout of the archangel, the trump of God, and then to suddenly realize that we were in the presence of our Lord. But that day will come. That day will come, and we want to talk about that today, since this is the Feast of Trumpets, and we'll take a look at that. I want you to turn with me. We'll begin in Luke, the 21st chapter, and we're going to turn back and forth between Luke 21, Mark 13. In Matthew 24, because the famous Olivet prophecy is recorded in these three chapters in these synoptic gospels. So we want to look at some of the elements in the Olivet prophecy, because interestingly enough, when you look at them, examine them together, you will see that there are some differences. Now, I'm not saying contradictions, I'm just saying differences. And what one tells you, the others sometimes fill in some blanks, some questions that come to mind. So that's what we're going to do today, is begin in Luke 21, and then we're going to go back to Mark 13 and see the same passage there, and then to Matthew 24, and then kind of back and forth. If you want to be marking those areas so you can get to them quickly, go ahead and do that. If not, then that's okay. I'll read them to you. Luke 21. Jesus is discussing the temple. Now, this is right at the end of his ministry, right before his death. And he is, in Matthew's account, he has issued this scathing rebuke against the scribes and the Pharisees. And he ends the discussion by calling on Jerusalem, by calling out, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem." And so on. But in any case, he points out in these chapters that the temple is going to be destroyed. Let's look at what he says there in chapter 21. Let's drop on down to verse 5. It says, "And while some were speaking of the temple, how it was adorned with noble stones and offerings, and indeed it was considered one of the wonders of that world, of the ancient world," he said, as for these things that you see, the days will come when there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." Now, what was he talking about? Was he talking about some future tribulation temple, or was he talking about the temple that they were standing there looking at? They were talking about the temple, obviously, that they were standing there looking at, that they were admiring, because it was a wondrous thing to behold. After all, this was the dwelling place of God on earth. This was the heart of Jewish worship at that time. God himself authorized its existence. He placed the priesthood there. He authorized the sacrifices that were brought and presented to him there. So this was the very heart of Jewish worship. And then here is Jesus, when they're admiring this great wonder, coming and saying, "This is all coming down." And you know what? It did. It did in AD 70, within a generation, at 40 years of the time he spoke these words. So let's continue, though. I want to call your attention to verse 7, to the question that's asked of him concerning this thing that he's just said. And they asked him, "Teacher, when will these things be?" Now notice the question. Notice it very carefully. We're going to compare it with the other accounts. "When will these things be? And what will be the sign when these things are about to take place?" What things are they talking about here? Well, the destruction of the temple, the throwing down of every stone. When will these things, that's what they're talking about, and what will be the sign when these things are about to take place? Let's go back to Mark's account, Mark 13, and see what he says here. It says in verse 3, and he sat on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple. So that gives you a little more information, at least as far as the location. And now we're told who those disciples were that asked him. It says, Peter and James and John and Andrew asked him privately, tell us, when will these things be? And again, he just has described the throwing down of the stones of the temple, the destruction of the temple. When will these things be? And what will be the sign when all these things are about to be accomplished? A little worded a little bit differently, but it's the same thing, isn't it? They're wanting to know when that temple is going to come down. Okay, now then, go back to Matthew's account. Here we're going to find an additional element thrown in. An additional element. In Matthew's account, let's just start there in verse 1, read down to it. Jesus left the temple and was going away when the disciples came to point out to him the buildings of the temple. Basically the same thing we read in the other two accounts. But he answered them, you see all these, do you not? Truly I say to you, there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down. We've read that before, haven't we? What is he talking about? That temple, the one they were looking at. Verse 3, as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, tell us, when will these things, that's destruction of the temple, when will these things be, and what will be the sign, now get this, something new, what will be the sign of your coming and of the close of the age? The other accounts didn't say that, did they? Now we see there's something else in view here. It is the coming of the Lord, the end of the age. And yet, for some reason, this is associated here with the destruction of the temple. Now I ask you, was the temple destroyed? Oh yes, long ago. You know, in the arches of Titus in Rome, there are still artwork showing the Roman soldiers carrying off artifacts from the temple. It's a fact. It came down, AD 70. It was a horrible massacre in Jerusalem during that time. Exactly what Jesus said about that turbulent time befalling Jerusalem and the temple being destroyed took place. And the temple has not been rebuilt. It has not been rebuilt. Israel may be established as a nation, but the temple has not been rebuilt. So there was a permanent change there, at least so far as we can see, a permanent change. So it's what I want to point out to you, though, is what he says here about this additional element. That event we know took place in AD 70 is somehow or other connected with, associated with, his coming, which is what this day pictures. How can that be? How can that be? These two far apart events, because last time I checked, he hadn't come yet. Would you agree with that? Now, some people actually say he did. He came back in AD 70. They actually do. The preterists, the full preterists, full-blown preterists, that's what they believe. He came in AD 70. All the apostles were taken up. They're in the kingdom right now, up there. They're in the kingdom. And that was the second coming. You say, well, what about us? What about the church remain? That couldn't be possible. That we know that a church remained and existed after AD 70. Well, guess what that was? That's the false church. Anyway, we won't go there today. But that is actually the belief that's out there. But you and I know that Jesus Christ has not yet returned. It's been almost 2,000 years since the temple was destroyed. And still, you ask the question, how are these two events here connected? Now, reading on, while we're here in Matthew, let's read on. He goes on to talk about some of the signs when these things will begin to happen and so on. But I want to skip on to verse 15 while we're here, then we'll go to the other accounts. Verse 15, so when you see, this is what he says relative to his coming. when you see, or relative to this tribulation coming upon Jerusalem, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, now what could that be? What could this abomination that stands in the holy place that Daniel refers to, what could that possibly be? Sounds to me like an idol standing in the temple. Would you agree? Or at least something abominable standing in the holy place, meaning the temple. Well, you know, there's different ideas about this. For one, we know that shortly before AD 70, the Zealots, who were a murderous group, there were Jews, but their idea about driving out the Romans was murder. They wanted to kill them. They wanted to use terrorist tactics, quite frankly. And they were not above killing their own people if they perceived that their own people were in collusion with the Romans. So this was a pretty nasty bunch. And it is known that they were in the precinct of the temple before AD 70, and that would have been considered desecration of the temple. So there was an abomination there in that sense. But more than that, also, we know that the Roman armies, when they came in, you know, they had their insignias, their shields and swords and flags and all. They had their pagan symbols. Their symbols representing their pagan religion. And they brought those into the temple. So you might say this was fulfilled in any number of ways. But anyway, he says, so when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, and this, interestingly enough, this account and one of the others said, let the reader understand. Now, some people will interpret that to mean, let the reader understand, since Matthew allegedly wrote after the event, let the reader understand that this, we know this is something's already happened, but, no, I don't think that. I think that's a very implausible explanation. I think the true explanation of this, since it's quoted in two places, if these are the words of Christ himself, it's not an insert. The words of Christ himself, and it is instructional. He's saying, let the reader of what? Not this gospel. Let the reader of Daniel understand. This is instruction to you and to me from our Savior to read and understand the prophet Daniel. Now, why is that significant? Because Daniel was told, because he didn't understand the things he was writing, he was told, go your way, Daniel. Go your way, because the time is not yet. He talked about those who are going to and fro and so on, and said, talk about a time when knowledge would be increased. Now, I used to think, oh yeah, now today we're living in the time of knowledge being increased because we have all this technology. We put men on the moon. We've done all these. That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about knowledge of the things that were revealed to Daniel that Daniel himself did not understand. That knowledge will be increased. And what Jesus is saying here is read and understand. In other words, now you can understand it. The time has come. So that was for his disciples then, and it's for his disciples, you and me, today. We have a mandate from our Savior to read Daniel and to understand it. And we can. We can. But then he goes on to say, then, when you see this abomination of desolation, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. He says, let the one who is on the housetop not go down to take what is in his house. What does that mean? It means you're not to plan a vacation, you're just to vacate. Because you don't have time to gather your things. When you see this, destruction is imminent. Get out. So he goes on in that way for a few verses. And then he goes on down to verse, well, let's just read on down to it. Let the one who is in the field not turn back to take his cloak. And alas, for women who are pregnant and for those who are nursing infants in those days, pray that your flight may not be in the winter or on a Sabbath. Now, why is that? It's not because you would be breaking the Sabbath if you were fleeing for your life. You're allowed to do that on the Sabbath. You're allowed to run out of town if somebody's trying to kill you. You don't say, I'm going to stay here and keep the Sabbath and die. No, you can do that. Because it's in those days, under those circumstances, it's harder to do this, to travel on the winter or on the Sabbath. For then will be great tribulation, such as has not been from the beginning of the world until now, no, and never will be. He's still talking about the destruction of the temple. He's still talking about getting out of Jerusalem when they see those forces coming in that's going to destroy it and going to wreak havoc in Jerusalem itself. And if those days had not been cut short, no human being would have been saved, and so on. We'll stop there, but let's go on over to Mark's account. Remember what we read, verse 15, for you will see the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place. When you see that, then you know it's time to get out. Mark says in verse 14, but when you see the abomination of desolation standing where it ought not to be, presumably the holy place, or obviously the holy place, because that's what Matthew says. Here it is again. Let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. And he goes on and continues very similarly to Matthew. Let the one who is on the housetop not go down nor enter his house to take anything out. And let the one who is in the field not turn back to take his cloak and so on. Again, what's he talking about? The destruction of Jerusalem. Now, let's go to Luke. Luke's account, I think we're going to see something here that adds clarity to what has been said so far. Well, I wanted to read, maybe one other statement. Yeah, let me just, back in Mark's account, the way he puts it here, he says in verse 18, pray that it may not happen in winter. For in those days there will be such tribulation as has not been from the beginning of the creation that God created until now and never will be. So it's similar to what Matthew says. But in Luke's account, let's look at Luke's account and look at verse 20. Jesus says, but when you see, he doesn't say anything about the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place. Look what he does say. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation, at least he has that word in there, has come near. So this whole thing could be understood as the army itself is the abomination that will come and make Jerusalem desolate. So when they saw the Roman armies, they were looking at the abomination of desolation, or abomination that makes desolate. The armies were indeed an abomination to those people, not only because of their idolatry and paganism, but also because of what they're about to do to the city here in this situation. So that's a possible understanding. All of these things are possibilities. But again, it's important to understand what we're talking about here so far. So far, the disciples are wanting to know about these things being the siege on Jerusalem that will result in the destruction of the temple, which we know is past now, long past. Happened in AD 70. He goes on to say, as did the others, as do the other writers, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are inside the city depart, and let not those who are out in the country enter it. For these are days of vengeance to fulfill all that is written. All that is written about Jerusalem. All that is written concerning the curses that will become that will come upon this people for breaking the covenant. Alas, for women who are pregnant and for those who are nursing infants in those days, for there will be great distress upon the earth and wrath. Earth could be translated upon the land, meaning land of promise, and against this people, the people who were there in Jerusalem. They will fall by the edge of the sword and be led captive among all nations. Now again, I ask you, we know that in Matthew's account, The question includes a question not only about what we know happened in AD 70, the destruction of the temple, but also in connection with that, there's the second coming is mentioned. The end of the age is mentioned. And I ask again, how are those very wide apart, far, those distant apart two events connected? Is there a connection? Is there some sense, is it possible that there's some sense in which the tribulation did not end in AD 70? Is there a some sense? I'm saying, notice some sense in which there's a continuation somehow that extends on out even to our time and beyond? There is a key. There is a key of understanding. It's right here in this verse, the next verse, or this section, the section we're in right now. This verse. Let's read it again. They will fall by the edge of the sword and be led captive among all nations. They were. We know that. You know, the Jews of the city of that time were taken as slaves. Some were taken actually to Egypt by ships, as the prophet, as God said through Moses. They would be. They were, even at that time. Not the only time they were for covenant breaking. And Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles. It was indeed. But get this. Here it is. Here's the key. Until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. There it is. What is the connection between the destruction of Jerusalem and the second coming? Times of the Gentiles. They are still going on. You see, the tribulation that befell Jerusalem in AD 70, the destruction of the temple, the time of distress that befell that city and those people then and there was a part of this, the times of the Gentiles. In other words, the times in which Israel was being dominated by other nations. And were they not being dominated? Were they not under the power of Rome even at this time? Yes, they were. Even while they were in the land, the times of the Gentiles was going on. The times of the Gentiles. So yes, that event is just an expression. The turbulent time is just one of many expressions of the times of the Gentiles. Because it was the Gentiles, namely the Romans, that came in and destroyed the temple and besieged that people and killed many of them. And the times of the Gentiles then continues down to our time. You may say, well, Israel's a nation again, isn't it? It's a secular nation. You don't think they once again revived the covenant and renewed their covenant vows and all that. Do you think that's happened? Oh, no, 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 no. There are probably as many atheists in Israel as there are people who believe in God. No, it's a secular nation. It is not a nation that everybody's looking to God and thinking about God and wanting to get the temple built and wanting to worship God and restore worship. You have some of those there. But no, it's a secular nation. They don't even like it. Many of them don't even like their own rabbis who live there. Say, stop persecuting these Christians and Muslims. Leave them alone. We're a secular nation. People ought to have freedom to believe whatever they want. So no, they're still under the dominion of the nations, the Gentiles. And that will persist until something happens. Guess what that will be? The second coming of Jesus Christ. So there is your connection between the AD 70 destruction of Jerusalem and the temple and the coming of Christ. And by the way, that was not the only tribulation that befell Jerusalem. You know, many people did return there, resettle that land. They were back there again, and it happened again. What was 135, I believe, was the date? Another terrible slaughter. Those are just expressions of this continuing and persisting time, or these times of the Gentiles. So you see what we're dealing with here, don't you? Now back to Matthew 24. Matthew 24. And this helps us to make sense of something that always, when I would read this and realize, hey, this is talking about the destruction of the temple back then. And this helps me to make sense of this particular passage. Understanding it this way, connecting those two events, the destruction of the temple, the coming of Christ, by times of the Gentiles. You know, after he describes this abomination of desolation, this great tribulation to befall Jerusalem, and that's when the temple is destroyed, of course, then he says, remember, he has said in verse 21, for then shall be great tribulation, and he says in verse 29, he says, immediately. That word always threw me for a loop. You know, I had this really, really smoothly operating gearbox. This was the monkey wrench that got tossed into it and jammed up the whole works. Until I realized that he's talking, that the times of the Gentiles extends far beyond the tribulation that befell Jerusalem in AD 70. It's ongoing today. But he says in verse 29, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn. And they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. You know, some people, in looking at this, they've run into the same monkey wrench in the gearbox. So they've looked at this and said, you know, whatever he's talking about here had to have happened back then, because it says immediately after the tribulation of those days. So what do they do? They say, well, wait a minute, coming of the Son of Man doesn't mean second coming. So then they start piecing together prophecies and statements from Scripture. So wait a minute. Back in the Old Testament, God described the punishments he brought upon Israel and other nations in terms of his visiting them. Now, he didn't show up physically. I mean, he wasn't there for people to see him. But he said, in the day that I visit you. In other words, he was coming in wrath. That, oh, that's it. He's coming in wrath. Not visibly coming. Every eye shall see him. Well, that just means, the people looking up and seeing, oh no, they'll see the evidence that that's what he's doing. They'll see the evidence. Oh, that's it. That's it. The evidence that the Son of Man is up in heaven now. That he has already come on the clouds of heaven, come to the Ancient of Days, as Daniel says. That's the way the partial preterists interpret this passage. The full preterists say, no, he came. He's already come back. He has caught up the saints. He caught up the apostles. No apostles appeared after this, supposedly. And the church, the true church, and left behind the false church. And then the question comes up, well, what about today? Are there any true Christians today? They say, oh, yeah, they're true Christians. Well, what about the resurrection? Are they forever without hope? There will not be a resurrection? Oh, no, their resurrection is resurrected at the moment they die. You just can't see it. They get their spiritual bodies and go up to the kingdom, which is up there. You see how people struggle with a verse, a passage like this. I say the simple solution is to understand that immediately after the tribulation of those days is not restricted to the days in Jerusalem in AD 70, but takes in this entire, at some point, all or at least the end of the period of this times of the Gentiles, which involves multiple tribulation times. That tribulation back then is only one expression of this overall pattern of tribulation. And so immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be dark and so on. You have a hard time with explaining how that could be unless you understand the times of the Gentiles were going on then and will continue until Jesus Christ returns. So then you can understand, after the tribulation of those days, immediately after the tribulation of those days. In other words, there will come a time when God says, enough. Come a time when says, stop. And he will restore Israel to its status that he intended for it to begin with. not only Israel, of course, will reach out to all the nations. He'll deal with those nations that come against Jerusalem, of course, and preserve a remnant of the people. So that's what we're dealing with here, I do believe. I think that's the best explanation. Now then, concerning the times of the Gentiles, let's go back to the book of Daniel. We were told that we should read and understand it, right? Let's go back there. We're just going to look at a little part of it today. You know, this is such a controversial book in the eyes of a scholarly world, because nobody can believe, it seems, that he actually wrote in the time that Nebuchadnezzar was king of the Neo-Babylonian Empire. And how? Why do they not believe that? He says so right there in chapter 1, when he was there. He was brought there in the first invasion by Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel was, with some of the other Jews. But it says he was, but they said, well, this is just a kind of a story that somebody put together in the 2nd century B.C., not all the way back as 605 or 547, not back then. No. He couldn't have. You know why he couldn't have? Because how could he have known all these things in advance? Nobody can know about the succession of kingdoms. Nobody can know all the details that Daniel knew about the Syrian kings. Alexander the Great, the Syrian kings that carved up his, the kings, actually, the four generals that carved up his kingdom afterward, and the Syrian kings, the succession of them mentioned in later in Daniel. And especially the focus on Antiochus IV, nobody could have known that unless they lived to see it. So that's the excuse. And yet here we have Daniel, this book saying it was in the third year, chapter 1, verse 1, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah. We know that was around 605 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom. And Daniel was among them. Daniel was among those. So that he was brought to Babylon in this first of three invasions of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, of Judah. So this text claims he was there back then. The scholarly world, the critical scholarly world, says, couldn't have been. Which will you believe? No, there's actually, we won't go into it today, there's an abundance of evidence that he did actually live back in that time. Not just internal to the scriptures, but the kind of text that is used and so on. But in any case, other than that, we will proceed with the belief that Daniel actually was there in the time of Nebuchadnezzar, was among the captives of that first invasion by Nebuchadnezzar. The next invasion was in around 597, and then in 587, a whole lot of history there. We won't go through it all, but in the last invasion, this was when the puppet king Zedekiah resisted foolishly. And Nebuchadnezzar, what do you do when you're under the power of a king like Nebuchadnezzar and you resist him? You rebel. What happens? You get slaughtered, usually. You get the rebellion gets put down in a very powerful way. So Zedekiah got his house burned down. He got Jerusalem got pretty much what it got in AD 70. And the temple was destroyed. And the rest of the people were brought to Babylon except for the poorest of the poor. They just left behind just a pitiful mess in that city. And of course, this was a part of what God had told them would happen if they were not faithful to the covenant. So this is the Babylonian exile. The Babylonian exile. And what Nebuchadnezzar dreams is prophetic, and Daniel interprets it because it has to do with those kingdoms that would be dominant over those people brought to Babylon, over the covenant people, the Jews, over Israel, put it that way, for such a long period of time. Now, yes, it's absolutely true that the people came back to their homeland. They came back to the land of promise under Cyrus the Persian in the next kingdom, in the succeeding kingdom, the Medo-Persian kingdom. They came back to the land. But the truth is they were still, in many respects, or actually they were still in exile. You know, you can be in exile. It's like being under house arrest. You may be home, but hey, you're restricted. And that's the way it was. They were still under the dominion of foreign powers. They were for hundreds of years, all the way to the time of Jesus and beyond. And finally, what happens? Well, the AD 70 event. And then 135. And then they've been scattered all over the world since then, regathering in Israel. But look, they're still, these people are still under the dominion of foreign powers. But here, Daniel, you know the story. I'm not going to go through the whole story about how Nebuchadnezzar has this troubling dream and he wants it interpreted. But finally, it comes down to it. Only Daniel can do this. It says in verse 31, "You saw, O king, and behold, a great image. The image, mighty and of exceeding brightness, stood before you, and its appearance was frightening. The head of this image was of fine gold." Now, I want you to notice as we go down these, mention the body parts here, that you have in descending order the value of the metal. But you also have, if you measure the length of each body part that he refers to, beginning with the head, you will see that though the length of the head aligns with the period of time in which the kingdoms they represent, the body parts, aligns well with the period of the kingdoms each body part represents. So let's go on down. Let's just read on through this. "The head of the image was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its middle and thighs or sides bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly iron and partly clay." Of course, we know that's not a good mixture there. "As you looked, the stone was cut out by no human hand, and it struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold all together were broken in pieces and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them could be found. But the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This was the dream. Now we will tell the king its interpretation. You, O king, the king of kings." Of course, that's the way he was perceived at that time, with all his conquests and all of that, all his riches. "To whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power and the might and the glory, and into whose hand he has given wherever they dwell, the children of men, the beasts of the field, and the birds of the heavens, making you rule over them all. You are the head of gold." The king, of course, is synonymous with his kingdom. So he's saying the Babylonian kingdom is the head of gold. "Another kingdom, inferior to you, shall arise after you." We know what that was. The Medo-Persian kingdom. It was during that period that the people did go back to the promised land. But they were still under dominion of the Persians. "And yet a third kingdom of bronze, the Grecian kingdom, which shall rule over all the earth. And there shall be a fourth kingdom." Some people, the liberal or the, I should say, the critical scholars, like to say, well, this is simply the Syrian kings here. No, it's not. We won't go into why it's not. It's not. It is not. This is the Roman kingdom. "And there shall be a fourth kingdom strong as iron, because iron breaks to pieces and shatters all things, and like iron that crushes, it shall break and crush all these. And as you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it shall be a divided kingdom." Now he's still talking about that kingdom, the fourth. He said nothing about a fifth. A lot of people say the feet represent a fifth kingdom. Not really. No, it's in some way at least a continuation of the way. It's part of the fourth. And it says, you shall be a divided kingdom, but some of the firmness of iron shall be in it, just as you saw iron mixed with the soft clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly iron and partly clay, so the kingdom shall be part strong and partly brittle. Even though it's strong like iron, it has all these, it crushes all these other nations and so on, and expands its influence, its power. Nevertheless, it has some very serious weaknesses within it. And we know as a kingdom like that, as it expands, it takes in new cultures, doesn't it? And it takes in all the features of those cultures. So you might have had a very powerful, very strong base of law and order, as you had in the Roman Empire. You had a powerful military. You had all of these things, a powerful central government. And yet, as the empire expands, it takes in all of these other regions. And then you start having political diversity, and that begins to weaken the kingdom. And that's basically what happened. There's much more to it than that, but that's part of the history of the Roman Empire. As you saw the iron mixed with soft clay, so they will mix with one another in marriage, metaphorically, but they will not hold together, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed. Now, you can look at this and say, wait a minute, the Roman Empire fell a long time ago. So did God, the God of heaven, set up a kingdom? Have the nations been, did all of this be, was it like chaff? You know, just little pieces that were blown away? Or is there some sense in which all of this, all these kingdoms, or what was left of all these kingdoms is transferred now down to our time? Yes, there is. You know, where do you think Western civilization came from? That one day a bunch of us were real smart and just invented it? No, goes back to the Greeks, handed over to the Romans, made its way up to British Isles. That's how it got to the peoples that probably most of us have some ancestry linking back to. But that's, you know, we have the many elements, so many elements of these kingdoms remaining, and our governments are based on it. So really, what are you talking about when you're talking about the image as a whole? You're talking about the kingdoms of this world, aren't you? You're talking about the worldly system that nations today are in some way plugged into. That's what we're talking about, really, isn't it? Now, we could talk about, you know, how this will play out in the end. I don't want to get into specifics about which nations are going to be involved and all. I don't want to go there. Just as an overall statement, I would say, I think it's certainly true, that the components that existed in this succession of kingdoms, they still exist in the kingdoms of this world today. Let's read on here. So again, in verse, it says, it shall break in pieces all these kingdoms and bring them to an end, and it shall stand forever, talking about the kingdom of God. Just as you saw a stone was cut out from a mountain by no human hand, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver. You see, all these components are still there. They're still there. Each one, you know, each kingdom, when it absorbs another kingdom, when it conquers and absorbs, it absorbs many of its characteristics. And that's what you had from the Babylonian Empire. The Persians absorbed the Babylonians. The Grecians absorbed the Persians and everything else they absorbed. And then the Romans, the Grecians. That's just the way it works. So you have components, you have characteristics from all of these kingdoms in the kingdoms of the world today. This is the worldly system we're looking at. And what this is telling us is it's going to be crushed. It's going to be crushed. Just as you saw a stone was cut out from the mountain by no human hand, and then it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold. A great God has made known to the king what shall be after this? The dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure. So this stone that is cut out from the mountain and strikes the image on the feet, do you know when that will happen? Shall I say when that process begins happening? On the very day that this day pictures, when Jesus Christ returns from heaven. When the promise is fulfilled, that when the disciples looked up and said, the angel appeared, said, why are you standing gazing in heaven? The same Jesus whom you see ascending to heaven will so come in like manner. In that day, he will crush the image on his feet, as it were. And that's what we're looking forward to. And this is this prophecy here, then, even though it may appear to be have ended with the demise of the Roman Empire, no, the times of the Gentiles persist. They're still ongoing today. That means that the people of God, whoever, wherever they are under the dominion of foreign powers. But this prophecy tells us, Daniel tells us, Jesus tells us, that that time will come to an end. It comes to an end when Jesus Christ returns. So I can say with the end of the book of Revelation, you know how it says, let the Spirit and the bride say, come. And whoever hears the prophecies of this book say, come. Even so, come quickly, Lord Jesus.